You're listening to an archived version of the PDF Network call featuring special guest Brian Civek, the District of Columbia's former CTO, on the subject, Digital DC, How to Create a New Culture of Digital Government. The call was recorded on March 17, 2011, and is presented here in its entirety. For more information on the PDF Network and upcoming calls, please visit personaldemocracy.com.
Hi, everybody. This is Micha Sifri from Personal Democracy Forum, here with you again for another one of our regular PDF Network conference calls with movers, shakers, thinkers, and innovators in the political technology space. As always, we are thankful to our sponsor, AT&T, for making these calls possible. This week, we are really pleased to be joined by Brian Civek, who until recently was the Chief Technology Officer of the City of Washington, D.C. And Brian is going to be joining us to talk about Digital D.C. and how you can drive a culture of change inside government to embrace the possibilities that networked communications technology bring both to how government works inside as well as how it works in relation to the public. A little background on Brian. He is perhaps not your typical government bureaucrat. His background really is much more in being a software entrepreneur. He helped start a company in 1998, worked in the arena for more than a decade, and was actually hired in 2009 by Mayor Fenty to fill the shoes of Vivek Kundra, who folks know went on to be the Obama administration's first chief information officer. And in some ways, those were perfect shoes to have to fill because Kundra had already launched a lot of important programs inside D.C.'s government using technology and also with open data. In some respect, Brian was building on Vivek's shoulders. But he has plenty of his own war stories to share on what the struggle to change the culture of government is like from the inside. So we're really, really looking forward to this hour. Before I hand off the baton to Brian, I'll just remind folks that the format for our call will be for the first half hour, it'll just be me and Brian talking, and then in the second half, we'll let you pose questions. The way to do that will be to hit *6 on your phone to get into the caller queue, and then I can call on people and unmute your phones for you. So thank you for joining PDF Network call. Brian, take it away.
Sure thing. Thanks, Micha. First of all, thank you very much for having me on the call. This is a subject matter that is pretty important to me and one that we worked quite a bit on in D.C., so I'm happy to be able to share some of the, as you said, war stories with.
Sorry.
Oh, no problem. As you said, as you described, I probably do have a somewhat different background than most government bureaucrats. I think the focus, if you wanted to set a focus of my career to this point, it really has been to bring innovative technology solutions to bear on solving problems that exist in general. And, the public sector is a real interesting place to do that. My first efforts were through a company I started in San Francisco in the late 90s. I moved to London in 2005 to expand it to Europe and Asia. And in 2009, then-Mayor Adrian Fenty brought me on board, and I pretty much immediately set to work trying to help district residents and visitors get more out of the city and the services that we provided through these innovative applications of technology, both internally and externally. It's funny. A funny thing kind of happened right at the beginning. I noticed quickly that, there was a great deal of low-hanging fruit to be had. Actually, mm-hmm. Somebody once described it to me, once described working in the D.C. government to me as hunting in a zoo. I noticed that creating and sustaining a significant change on the technology front would really require something much more fundamental and I think a lot more difficult, which is specifically a significant shift in the culture of government.
Hmm.
You know, when you think about it, I think the big problem is that for the most part, elected officials these days are really motivated by fear more than anything else. You know, you've got your 24-hour news cycles. You've got people getting information from, you know, biased information from 30-second TV spots and networks that lean one way or another. And, you know, no politician really wants to see their administrations criticized for any reason at all. And then you have the media that's actually doing the criticism. They're constantly looking for the gotcha stories. And this really feeds a kind of unvirtuous circle, which I think drives elected officials really deeper into their shells. So I think we need a fundamental reset of the way the government actually works. And in this case, technology can be an enabler, but really only if those who are enabling it are interested in, you know, making this fundamental deep change. I think it's pretty clear that innovation really does truly happen on the edges. So one of the big challenges when I started was focusing on how to encourage these edges to break out of the status quo, you know, to get out of this cycle of fear and really truly innovate. So at the Office of the Chief Technology Officer, or OCTO, we set out to do pretty much just this. And in general, you know, I saw my role there as I think perhaps a bit different than many agency directors or typical government leaders. My view of the job really was to point the ship in a very specific direction and then make course corrections along the way as things came up. And, you know, the folks that are pulling the oars, the ones that are actually doing the work, are the ones that I think have the best ideas about ways to make various processes and products more efficient and better. And so a big part of my job, as I saw it, was to really provide air cover if the ideas didn't work out or if they needed to be tweaked, you know, if something went wrong. So in short, I really had to make it not only okay to fail, but to celebrate rapid and cheap failure as successes as opposed to losses. So for me, this really all started, I think you can kind of go back to my literally my sixth day on the job. And I had an all-staff meeting to sort of introduce myself and my ideas. And I pointed out to the agency that our mission was really to serve our customers. If you could see me now, I'm making little air quotes around that word. And those customers would be the internal agencies and employees that relied on the services we provided, as well as the residents and visitors to D.C. who take advantage of everything that the city has to offer from the services we provide, as well as from a technology-focused perspective. So I explained further that within this general mission, our main focus should really be on creating as high a level of customer satisfaction as possible, whatever that takes. And I use some examples from the private sector. Take, you know, Zappos as a good example, a company that has an incredibly high-performing operation, and they got where they were by focusing more on customer sat than anything else. And then I sort of closed it by announcing to, at this point, what admittedly was a probably very skeptical crowd, that I wanted everyone to focus on thinking about new ways to execute their personal missions and their jobs without being afraid to fail. And that, you know, I was always available to discuss any issue. I had their back, you know, anytime, any place. And, you know, this it was funny because this was one of my favorite parts of that meeting. Right after I finished, the very first question I got was, this all sounds great. And it all sounds really familiar, and you know, it hasn't worked in the past, so how do we know that you're telling the truth? And, you know, my response to that was really the only honest one I could think of on the spot, which was basically that they'd have to, you know, simply trust me. But I think the interesting, you know, thing to note out of that is that the guy who actually asked the question, instead of me, you know, kind of coming down on him for calling me out on something like that, actually ended up becoming one of my closest allies in the agency in trying to affect some of this change.
Right.
So, you know, kind of fast forward a little bit, I think, you know, these things had some very interesting effects. People have been entrenched in years of bureaucracy, and so it took a while for people to come around to this viewpoint. But as, you know, changes started occurring in the way that people looked at their jobs, we could see some really specific and significant effects. The agency itself was and is organized in a relatively traditional way. It's very siloed, and it's structured in such a way that individual groups tended to work within themselves to solve problems that came up. But as it turns out, most of the issues that we faced were really necessary to deal with across the agency. You needed to get lots and lots of different people involved. So this new focus on customer service really required people to break out of these silos and actually, for the first time in a while, engage with other people in the organization. I think the really interesting thing about this, too, is that it provided really a lens for people to view any decision that they had to make through. So whenever they were faced with a specific choice, people quickly came to terms with the fact that the right decision was the one that maximized customer satisfaction. Along with those sort of symbolic wall breakings, we engaged some in actually some physical wall destruction as well. I'm a big hater of physical barriers in workplaces. I think that they, you know, tend to create mental barriers. They prevent communication. And so one of the things that we did was actually started physically breaking down walls and cubes in workspaces and creating communal workspaces with lots and lots of breakout space. And this had a huge impact on communication and collaboration. I think a lot of people have heard about Mayor Bloomberg and Mayor Fenty's bullpen-style operations. And, mm-hmm. you know, we sort of took that a step further and really just, you know, I mean, literally removed as many walls as possible.
This is just in Octo, right? I want you to just clarify. Octo is the technical division of the government. We're talking about, what, several hundred employees and out of how many?
Yeah, so Octo, basically the agency is about 600 people. It's a mix mm-hmm. of contractors and FTEs. The D.C. government overall is about 36 to 38,000, depending on who and when you ask. Mm-hmm. And we were responsible for basically every aspect of technology internal to the government. So we managed all the ERP systems, email, all the telecommunications and networks, all of that kind of stuff. And then we also did customer-facing technology.
Customer as opposed to the customer being somebody inside some other branch of the government.
That's right.
Mean both. I mean customers, you have two kinds of customers really, right?
Exactly. And that's sort of what I tried to explain in the very beginning was that, you know, if we were going to look at our constituencies as customers, we had to kind of break it down between the internal and the external. On the external side, you know, we focused on lots of stuff. Digital divide was a big, big thing for us, providing broadband to the masses along with the things that go along with broadband access in order to bridge that gap. And then, you know, we also were really responsible for helping all of the other agencies detail their plans for technology implementations that could help them deliver better products and services. So it was a pretty wide-ranging role. But allowed us to, I think, really innovate in some interesting ways.
Mm-hmm.
One example, I think, along with some of the things that I just mentioned would be something like our implementation of an internal microblogging tool called Yammer, which probably many people have heard of or have probably used.
Mm-hmm.
It was an interesting rollout. We set it up and we didn't actually mandate its use. I think.
Well, say a little bit more for folks who don't know. Describe what Yammer is.
Sure, Yammer is like Twitter, but it's for internal collaboration, basically. It has many of the same features and it just allows for quick communication across multiple devices. So you can have a web client, you can have a client on your mobile. We actually built a interface, an open source interface that we actually published to GitHub that would do a Twitterfall style display on the kiosk that we had sitting out in the reception in our office. So, mm-hmm. you know, we tried to make it very visible, but we didn't actually.
So what would somebody see if they were using it? What kinds of messages would it show?
Well, you know, that's part of the interesting thing, right? So we started with just a few people, literally on my floor in my building, and we didn't mandate its use. We just sort of let it go and let it self-market, if you will. And the interesting thing to me was that it very, very quickly gained in popularity. And just a few months in, we had, you know, literally thousands of people who had joined the network from every agency, including the mayor's office and the city administrator's office. And so, you know, when it was just Octo, you know, obviously many of the conversations were technology focused, and some of them were about, you know, questions that people had in the course of doing their jobs and help that they needed from others. Some of them were, you know, discussions about iPads launching and things like that. But as we got other agencies involved, we started to see a lot more, you know, I think pretty interesting types of conversations. People talking about new initiatives that their agencies were launching, people looking for help and advice on how to do certain things, messages from the mayor's office and the city administrator's office. So it really took on a life of its own. And there were some interesting, you know, bumps in that road. Communications folks in the mayor's office and the city administrator's office were a little concerned, if you will, about, you know, potential leaks of information and things like that. So in order to, and that, you know, that's sort of a vestige of, I think, old government culture. In order to solve some of those problems, we, you know, basically just set them up on the system and said, look, you know, you'll see what's going on. And interestingly, most of these communities are very self-policing, and so I don't think you're going to see a lot of things that cause any issues. You know, it's one of those things where we can, you know, write terms of use and mandate specific, you know, ways of actually utilizing the system. But in a way, I feel like that kind of locks it down a little too much and prevents uses that we might not have thought of that could actually be very beneficial.
Right, but somebody so, getting on had to have a government, you know, they had to be, you know, not anybody could join, right? You had to, you were vetting or someone in your office was actually, you know, I can't, a government worker in D.C. couldn't invite 10 of their friends to use it.
No, you had to have a D.C.gov email address.
Right.
So right. So it was limited to the D.C. government. But, you know, that's 38,000 people, right?
Mm-hmm.
So,
were there any leaks? I mean, was there any stuff that sort of got out of control?
Not at all. Not at all. In fact, not only that, but, you know, I can't think of a single instance where somebody misused it or used it in an inappropriate way. And
did people ask for help in how to use it, or they just taught each other?
It was mainly people teaching each other. One of the things that I wanted to do actually towards the end of my tenure was set up sort of a little class on, you know, some of the features and some of the things that you could actually do with the tool, because I think that if you didn't utilize it correctly or, you know, take advantage of some of the features, I should say, then you were missing out on some of the benefit. Unfortunately, we didn't actually get enough time to actually do that, but it was something that that I definitely wanted to do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, fascinating, fascinating. Can you give us an example of you know, where you ran into you know, challenges that you couldn't surmount, or where, you know, to what degree does this require sort of the embrace and leadership from the very top in order to succeed?
Yeah, I think actually a really good example of that. So about halfway through last year, I sort of decided that it was time to kind of pull out the stops and really make some significant changes to the actual culture of government and the culture of the agency, and really try to make, you know, transform the agency into a almost like a Silicon Valley style workplace. And so we actually set off on a journey to implement a results-only work environment, or a RO. And for those of you who don't know what that is, the idea behind it is fairly simple. Basically, nothing matters except what you produce and what you deliver. And what that means is that, you know, we are all typically at any one of our jobs since the day we started in the working world measured by usually hours, right? Show up at 8:30, leave at 5:30. If you're not sitting at your desk the whole time, you're obviously not doing work. And the actual deliverable sort of falls below that. And, you know, it's interesting because if you think about it, we really should kind of look at it a different way. We're all hopefully responsible adults when we accept the job, and we should use that as the default starting point where, you know, you as a responsible adult who knows what your deliverables are should be able to make the right decisions in order to get those things done. And it doesn't mean, you know, sitting at your desk from this time to this time. If you do have to interact with people in order to do your job, then okay, you know, you need to make the decision that you have to be physically present in a certain space at a certain time because that, you know, that's when other people are going to be there. But other than that, you shouldn't have to, you know, we shouldn't be telling people what to do. We should be letting people make their own decisions. So, you know, it was one of these really interesting things when we started to roll this out. There, you know, it's so contrary to the way that we typically work that it took a while for people to really get their head around it. You know, a lot of people thought it was a work from home program, which it absolutely is not. While the idea is that you can work from home and you can work from wherever you want, and you can work from the beach if you want. The real critical component is that we're treating you like a responsible adult to make your own decisions, and we're going to measure you on the things that you are delivering, as opposed to when and where you are delivering them, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it was really interesting because you know the process itself made a lot of sense. You know, people in the mayor's office completely understood it. I think. And they were behind it. I think the big challenge was that I started to implement it kind of during the primary for the next mayoral election. The primary was in September, and the general was in November. And the thing about D.C. is that the general election doesn't really matter. It's such a democratic city that whoever wins the primary is basically the new mayor.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I kind of ran smack into a transition, unfortunately. And, you know, as forward-thinking as Adrian Fenty and his administration was, it was somewhat atypical for government. And I think that we kind of ran into that when the new folks were starting to take over. And so, unfortunately, it got shut down to a certain extent, you know, after the general election before and kind of during the transition.
But say a little bit more about your vision for how that would work, because I'm trying to wrap my mind around it. And, I mean, you're not talking about eliminating all structure to people's jobs, though, right? I mean, how do people deal with this idea, you know, given that there is still hierarchy, there's still differentiated responsibility, or does that all go up for grabs, too?
Well, not really. I mean, at the end of the day, you as an employer are still responsible for delivering certain things, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you are let's say you're a coder, you know, working on applications for the Department of Motor Vehicles, you are, you know, responsible for delivering the things that you have committed to deliver in certain timeframes. What we're just talking about doing is essentially basing the measurement of your performance on delivering those things as opposed to how you deliver those things. Right?
Mm-hmm.
With the assumption that if you do deliver them, you're making the right decisions in order to get them done. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, if you need to be in the office at, you know, 10 o'clock every morning for a general meeting with other people on your development team in order to, you know, make sure that there are no issues or, you know, nothing is going wrong. And we actually implemented agile methodologies as well right around the same time. So that was part of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
You are expected to make the right decision and be at that, whether you have to be physically present or whether you can, you know, WebEx or conference call in or something. That's again up to you and the team. But the deliverables are still there. There's sort of an interesting side effect to that too, which is that all of a sudden we have a much, much better way of measuring actual performance of employees, as opposed to a, you know, sort of annual performance review by the manager, which can get skewed in any number of different directions by, you know, personality conflicts or, you know, the manager basing a review on one of the more recent events rather than overall performance over the course of a year, that kind of thing. You actually have detailed data about how that employee is performing over the course of a period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so it makes that part of it and the performance measurement piece of it really, I think, very interesting. Especially in government where, you know, if you're going to look at, you know, disciplinary action or termination for low performers, you really do need a lot of that detail in order to say,
right,
well, you're not doing your job.
Right.
And so there was sort of a really interesting side effect of this, which created or which would have created something like that. You know, I think that, and there definitely, when we started talking about this, there was definitely a group, I think, within the agency that was a bit frightened about doing something like this, because if you are a low performer, it's going to smoke you out pretty quick.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my response to that is like, look, bottom line, in time of fiscal crunch, which we were definitely in, we don't have the resources or the spare seats to be able to afford low performers in any place in the organization. And, you know, we're trying to move as fast and as quickly as we can to accomplish the things that are on our plate. And if you're not pulling your weight, then we got to do something about that.
Right. We're coming close to the half hour mark. So I want to ask one other different question, and then we'll open up to people who are listening. Brian, can you give us an example of how, you know, in relation to changing the relationship between government agencies and the public that they're supposed to serve? I mean, we've heard a lot of talk about, you know, moving from the vending machine metaphor of government. You know, you put in money and services are supposed to come out, to a more platform model where government is trying to engage with citizens in co-creating better services. So I'm wondering if there are lessons there about, you know, what it takes to change the mentality of government workers so that that's okay, or even more, that that's rewarded, that kind of approach is something that people should aim for.
Sure. I think that actually kind of goes back to one of the first points I made around the idea that people are more motivated by fear than by anything else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you really need to change the general concept that people have about their jobs and let them understand that, you know, if they try something new, if they listen to the public, if they embrace a negative comment as opposed to, you know, brushing it aside or rejecting it, and actually solve some problems, there's a huge amount of benefit in that over the sort of typical, you know, batten down the hatches, you know, turn out the PR flunkies kind of approach, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that was actually one of the really, really big things that I tried to get across to most people, which was, you know, in the course of doing your job, you're going to come across any number of different ideas, either from yourself or from colleagues or from, you know, people that you run into on the street that happen to start talking to you about something that you're involved in. And if we don't provide a mechanism for people to actually experiment and innovate and try some of these new things, we're never actually going to change, right? And so, you know, what I really tried to convey to everybody was that, you know, I'm not going to punish you if you try something new and it goes wrong. You know, maybe if it's a really, really, really dumb decision and, you know, something horrible happens, yes, we'll have some words. But, you know, those situations, I think, are very, very few and far between. I think for the most part, you know, as long as we try new things and we innovate in ways that allow us to quickly identify where things are going wrong and then, you know, kind of course correct, we actually get a lot of benefit out of that. And it's really, you know, celebrating these failures as opposed to, you know, not talking about them, right? I wanted to encourage as many people as possible to try to innovate and to try to do new things. Actually, a really good example of that is an internal example.
Mm-hmm.
We had a team of people that were responsible for our middleware architecture, and we were using, when I got there, a relatively old proprietary product that had been end-of-life, and we were paying lots and lots of money for extended support on it, even though it had been end-of-life. And one day, one of the guys working on the team came up to me, and he actually gave me a proposal, a very well thought out, very detailed proposal for how we could get out of this, you know, proprietary, this sort of old, expensive proprietary situation, and move to an open source, open standards based solution for this middleware product. Which you know, middleware is, it's funny, it's not sexy, but it's critical, right? You got this application that's basically connecting lots and lots of other applications together and passing information back and forth. So you have to have that, and it has to be something that works.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he had, in his spare time, because he felt so strongly about the way that this stuff should work, came up with this proposal, presented it to me, and honestly, it was a no-brainer. You know, the details that he had put in there were clear, were concise, were complete, and so we went for it. And, you know, we were able to within the schedule that he defined and within the cost parameters that he defined, actually replace this older solution with this new open standards one. And, you know, I think that's a great example of you know, taking ideas from everybody out there and letting people run with them and not, you know, necessarily, you know, dragging your feet in bureaucracy and process when it's obviously a good idea.
Great. Well, you know, we're at the halfway point, and I want to start to open up the call to people who are waiting to ask questions. And so if you have a question, hit star six on your phone, and that will get you into the question queue. First person up, looks like it's Stephen Buckley. Go ahead, Stephen. Are you there? Hang on, it often takes a second for the mute to come off.
Okay, the lady said I'm unmuted now. Thank you very much.
Okay, welcome to the PDF Network.
Thanks for having us today. It's a subject that is near and dear to my heart, the idea of culture change in the government. I spent 25 years in D.C., and I worked for five different federal agencies. So they can vary, but the basic things that we make fun of in Dilbert comics exist all over the place to varying degrees. And I am particularly heartened to hear Brian talk about that the primary motivation is fear, because we can have all the wonderful technology in the world, but it's really just an enabler. And unless you go to the root causes of why people are afraid of the status quo and address those, mm-hmm. then all the technology in the world is not going to get people to stick their necks out if they know they're going to get chopped off. And I did bring this up during the Open Government Dialogue back in 2009. So if people go to Twitter and look for trans, I'm at transpartisan, they'll see a link there to how I've been trying to raise this. So very good.
Right.
Kudos to that. And I'd love to be able to carry on the conversation later sometime.
Do you have a question, Stephen, or you just wanted to make that
Well, that was it. I'm like, well, I guess the question is why more people are thinking that technology is going to save us. Anish Chopra was talking. I always hear him saying how he's going to hardwire the culture change. Do you agree with that, or do you think it's that we're relying too much on technology to change human behavior?
I actually want to take that question and sort of torque it slightly, if you don't mind. Because I think it's true that human nature and fear are still terribly important motivators. But Brian, do you think that maybe as the new generation comes in, right, and some of the older generation retire, that people's comfort level with some of these tools that are much more interactive, much more real-time, transparent in certain ways, that some of the culture will change just be like the same way that, two generations ago, the level of sexism in the workplace that was just accepted because that was the culture. There's been a big cultural shift, including, you know, obviously changes in the law and changes in workplace, rules. So I'm wondering to what degree you think that people's immersion in connection technology, the younger generation, is there less fear, or is it still an issue that you have to address directly by kind of reassuring people that it's okay to fail if they'll fail quickly?
So it's a great question and you know, sort of a great lead up to that question. And I think the answer has a lot of different facets to it. On one hand, we're going to have to change, especially in the technology area, because there are some jurisdictions out there that are going to lose something like 40 to 50 to 60% of their employees in the next 5 years, just due to people retiring who've been around forever. And that basically obviously implies that we need to find replacements for those people, which for the most part should come from the new generation of public servants, people who are graduating from college, who are entering the workforce for the first time, who have a desire to actually, you know, do some good in a community. Again, as you said, Mika, these people are used to different environments, right? They've grown up sharing almost everything about their lives, and they see no reason why not. I think that we're going to have a real hard time attracting people like that to public service if we don't make some significant changes. So, you know, I think that there will sort of be a let's change it from the inside phenomenon that we see, and I think we're seeing that today. You know, we all kind of go to these conferences all over the place around, you know, around open government and Gov 2.0 and all of this kind of stuff. And we tend to see the same groups of people, I think, at most of these things. And I feel like over the past couple of years, I've seen these groups slowly expand. So I think there is something to that. But I think we do have to make some fundamental changes to, you know, the way that we actually do things in order to attract more of the people that we want to attract. So I think it's kind of both, but I do think that the fundamental bottom line culture changes is one of the most important things that we can focus on.
Okay, great. Okay, our next caller.
Hi.
Just identify yourself and ask your question.
Great, thank you. This is my name is Jill Zeiman. I blog at Rights Like She Talks, but I'm also a city council member in a small... Hello?
Hi, Jill. Nice.
Hi,
nice
how
hear
are
your
you?
Voice.
Good. Yeah. I was elected in 2009, and I'm in my second year. I'm in a suburb outside of Cleveland. It's called Pepper Pike. And I really appreciate having this opportunity to ask you a couple of questions. I ask all the people I can think of these kind of questions, and honestly, some of the hurdles just don't seem to go away. So if it's okay, I'm just going to shoot them at you. We definitely have that generational issue that you were just talking about. And one of the problems that I find is that you can have all the savvy early adopters, regardless of their age, getting involved, but it's the purse string gatekeepers who aren't changing, in my opinion, quickly enough. And I'm not even that young. So part of what I'm dealing with, it's not only the fear, it's just outright refusal and resistance. So I'm constantly finding myself trying to think of how do I persuade them? How do I make them comfortable? How do I make them not feel threatened? And also, how do I get people to run to replace them? Those are all, you know, I think issues that, from what I can see, certainly in the Ohio landscape, many, many, many communities are dealing with. I think Ohio happens to be pretty far behind the curve in terms of moving forward. We have a brand new county government, which does seem to be acting much more quickly in terms of adopting and looking into the use of technology for efficiencies and just for good government. So I guess my questions have to do with what advice you have for, you know, what techniques you have found to kind of get around some of these hurdles, because removing them takes some time, and we're working on that. But I'm also interested in getting around them while we're working to remove them. And just last thing I'll say is I kind of see it the way self-serve gas pumps started to come in the 70s and 80s. You know, the price was going up, and that was seen as a way to cut the cost. But even now, you can still, if you want to, drive around and find your full-service gas stations. But by and large, as the decades have gone by and, you know, the generations have dropped off, people just accept that it's going to be self-serve. So I see a lot of my current colleagues as people who, you know, for them, they're just never going to be comfortable with online materials. We have a couple of colleagues of mine who don't use email, period, and I've been pushing. Yeah, so I'll stop there, but...
Send us the names of the ones who don't use email, okay? I think it sounds like a tech president story.
Yeah.
Brian, go.
So, you know, I think in a lot of ways it's, you know, you're talking about a basic sales job. And one of the things that I've actually found to be very useful, especially in government, is an approach which I don't think a lot of people tend to take, which is when you're dealing with people who are just, you know, really, you know, attached to the status quo, they like things the way they are, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, explain to them in detail until they really, really, truly internalize it and understand it, what benefits they personally will get out of it, right? And help them understand how they can then, you know, market those achievements to help them achieve their future goals. So a good example, you know, we've been doing open data in DC for a very long time. you know, there are some agencies and some data sets that have historically been sort of protected, and people have been kind of loath to release them. And this actually isn't the case in D.C. with this particular data set, but it's one that is the case in many places. Say, you know, the police department is very afraid to release crime data for lots and lots of different reasons. Now, we know it's possible because there are many jurisdictions out there that have released real-time crime data. But, you know, the typical reason for that is that the police leadership don't understand the benefits of putting that data out into the community. And if you can show them some examples of where jurisdictions that have released real-time crime data have then leveraged, outside services, whether they're for-profit enterprises or individual citizens who are just taking that data and doing something interesting with it, to, say, put in a predictive analytic program to, you know, determine where crime will happen before it happens, and then they can deploy their forces much more effectively and reduce the crime, which is their main motivation, then all of a sudden they start to get it, right? They start to see what's in it for them in order to take some of these chances. And I think that's really, honestly, the basic starting point for how to get people on board with this stuff is really help them get what's in it for them. You know, all they see when they first start out is risk, right? They see something that doesn't exist right now, something that might change, and they can see all the negative things that can happen, but they don't see any of the positives. And in most cases, the positives far, far outweigh the negatives, but they just need to understand what those are.
Great answer. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, next next question coming up. Your phone should be on mute.
Hey there.
Introduce yourself. And
hi. I'm Jen Jest. I worked on the Obama campaign and a couple other campaigns, and I'm now working for my congresswoman in New Haven and doing a lot of their data management, which has been sort of sorely neglected. And actually, your last answer just answered one of my big questions. But I think that there's another issue, too, which is communication around the office. And was Yammer just specific to what you did, or does that still exist?
You mean is it a tool that's out there in the world? Or?
Right.
Yeah, Yammer is actually a startup, essentially startup company out of California.
Okay.
They've got it's on a freemium model, right? So anybody can literally go up and sign up for it. And sign the organization up for it and start using it without paying anything. So it's a great way to just sort of try it and see what happens.
But
communication, I mean, it's a great point, right? Open conversations, open communication is a really, really big deal if you want to make some of this stuff happen, which is why, you know, I was saying earlier, not only did we try to address the cultural stuff, we actually tried to address the physical barriers as well.
Yes.
One of the things that I'm actually I'm saddest about in terms of not being there anymore is that roughly, I guess it was a few months into 2010, the district actually purchased a new building, which my agency was going to move into in a couple of years. And I got to have the honor of designing what the actual workspace would look like for my 600 people. And I'll always remember the first meeting with the interior architects because they'd done a few other jobs for different agencies in the city and, you know, built very typical government workspaces. And the first thing I said to them was, like, everything that you've ever done, forget about that, right? What I want is a space that literally has no walls. I'm even thinking about having a space that has no assigned seats, completely modular, tons and tons of breakout and conference space, places for people to collaborate, you know, all of that kind of stuff. I don't want an office. I don't want anybody else to have an office. I just want, you know, basically as open and as, you know, collaborative a space as we can possibly design. And their reaction was hilarious. I mean, their faces lit up, right? They never expected to get that kind of a job in the government. Now, unfortunately, I never got a chance to execute on that, but the designs were looking phenomenal, and it was going to be what I was hoping was a model for how government should operate from a physical perspective going forward. You know, and yes, we're the technology agency, and you know, you could say that it's sort of the Silicon Valley mindset and all that. But I really think that the results that we could have proven from that would have been hugely significant. And plus, There's a lower cost of construction because you don't have to build all these walls and, you know, offices and things like that. So it's actually it was going to be very cool, and I was bummed that we didn't get a chance to actually finish it.
It's interesting that way you say that, because I also work at a co-working area where they have the exact same thing. They have a major sort of bullpen area, but then they've got these other rooms where if you want to talk and you want to collaborate, you can go to those rooms. And now we're actually trying to set up times because some people want to talk at different times, and then we thought, you know, we should have lunch time where people can talk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, time management is another sort of secret ingredient here. How I was recently in the Google New York office to give a book talk, and got a little bit of a tour afterwards, and the person giving the tour said, we encourage people to take breaks every 90 minutes to 2 hours, that you cannot concentrate effectively on anything. Your brain needs a break. Your brain needs to, you know, sort of unconsciously simmer on things that while you're doing something else, whether it's taking a walk or getting something to eat or playing ping pong. So, yeah, but we don't have a ping pong table here at the PDF office. The next person waiting on the call to ask a question, please introduce yourself.
Hi, yes. This is Preston Ray. I am with the Open Technology Initiative at the New America Foundation, and we're doing work with the Bloomingdale Broadband Bridge Community Mesh Wireless Project here in D.C. So I really wanted to ask, having that you have been the chief of Octo before, we're really interested in understanding how we can get DCNet to be opened up for easy access to citizens, because we would really like to tap community broadband networks into that fiber. Octo has been reluctant to open it up like more freely. So was really interested to understand sort of what your recommendations are to how to approach Octo and how to get DCNet open so we can have easier access for community broadband projects.
Yeah, sure. And actually, it's a relatively straightforward answer. You have to understand that there are, you know, a few motivations. I mean, in any situation like this, you have to understand what the motivations on the other side are, right? And there are a few things that are going on, I think. And keep in mind, everything I'm saying is as of a few months ago when I left. But first of all, the main mission of DCNet is to provide continuous and robust services to government agencies, right? That's how it was designed. That's how the money was raised for it. That's you know, what it was built for. So that's the main mission, and the things that it fits into has to take that into account. Secondly, there's a huge budget problem in the district right now, just like many other places. And while DCNet can provide interesting services and lots of I think value to the Broadband Bridge Project, which you guys know I'm a big supporter of, I think that we need to take into account the fact that there are things that cost money that aren't budgeted for. So, you know, who pays for the bandwidth? Who pays for the equipment? All of that kind of stuff. These are the questions that I think, the Broadband Bridge guys, you guys need to figure out answers to and come at it from that perspective. It kind of goes back to an answer to an earlier question, right? You have to help people understand what's in it for them and understand what their motivations are in order to solve those problems.
Okay. So, Brian, if other people have questions, hit *6, and we'll get you back into the queue. Brian, can you talk a little? We've talked a lot about the sort of cultural change at Octo in the office of the Chief Technology Officer of DC. But I'm wondering if you can give us some sense of how your example has rippled out into other parts of the government bureaucracy in D.C., and where you think, the best lessons are. Given that the technology office wants to attract people from the technology sector, I mean, to some degree you're competing against private sector companies that are more agile and open in their style, whereas other branches of government, you know, their attitude may be, well, you know, what those guys did over at Okta is nice, but, you know, we don't have to do it. So, you know, given that the subject of our call is how you can drive that sort of change in culture further, what insight can you offer on how that did or didn't play out in your time in D.C. government?
Well, you know, I think the critical thing is actually showing tangible results from a lot of these things, right? And if we can prove that in various cases we're actually, you know, increasing efficiency or saving money or what have you, we're actually going to be making a very good leadership by example argument to mm-hmm. other folks out there who are interested in doing something like that. And if you have the right elected officials behind you and the right style of leadership who are focused on efficient management and efficient operations, then they're going to jump all over this stuff. And D.C. was definitely that way under Mayor Fenty. You know, anything that we did across the government that, you know, was innovative or that, you know, showed positive and tangible results, he was a huge supporter of. Mm-hmm. And so if we had put something in place that showed value, you know, it could be mandated that other agencies do it. We could find other agencies that were interested in doing it and help them along. You know, here's a great example. We implemented the first have you ever heard of Net Promoter Score, out of curiosity?
No. You'll have to explain it.
Net Promoter Score is essentially a methodology for collecting information about how the customers of your products or services actually regard your products or services.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very, very simple sort of basic statement. You know, the basic question is, would you recommend this product or service to your friends or colleagues or what have you, or family or whatever? And then, you know, it's much more detailed than that in terms of actually designing these surveys and the analysis of those surveys. But what it actually does is provide you with a great deal of detail around which parts of your services and which parts of your products need to be tweaked in order to increase this customer satisfaction. And so this is something that has been going on in the private sector for a long time. We were actually the first, to my knowledge, the first government to adopt Net Promoter Score as a standard methodology for measuring the customer satisfaction of the services we provided. So the idea was basically to start it as a project for my IT help desk. Because those guys deal with people in other agencies 24/7. And so what I wanted to be able to say out of this was, how are their services actually being provided and which parts of the services need to be tweaked in order to make them better? And so the idea, though, was to roll it out there, get the program into a good place and get people sort of trained up on how to actually work with this methodology and work with the tools, and then have an area of practice that we could then roll out to other agencies. Maybe and hopefully even ones that face the customer. So imagine, you know, you're at the DMV and you go through the line, you get whatever it is done that you need to get done, and then you get a survey which you fill out on the spot that gets analyzed using this methodology to tell you exactly whether or not that individual had a good experience, right, and if
mm-hmm.
not, why.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden you've got all this data to actually make a decision on. My sort of end goal with this was that I wanted to roll it out to the city as a whole, right? Like, you know, just a random citizen. Would you recommend living in Washington, D.C. to your friend, family, or colleague, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if not, why? And if so, why? And that would actually, I think, provide a lot of data for the policymakers to actually start to make some interesting decisions about things that could be changed to actually make things better.
Mm-hmm. And what would stop that from happening? In other words, why aren't they doing that now?
Well, they might still be continuing. I don't know. Like I said, you know, since I've left, it's been a few months, and I don't really know exactly what's happening and what's not. I hope that they are, because I think that it was a really interesting way of doing things. If they're not, you know, what it might come down to is something as simple as people don't like to have their weaknesses exposed, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they don't like to, you know, admit to doing things incorrectly or admit to areas where improvements can be made.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, I think that's exactly the wrong attitude to have.
Right.
You know, actually, a story from my former life. You know, we were the software that my company created and sold was knowledge management software, and a component of that was customer forums, just basically bulletin board systems and stuff that integrated into the rest of the application. And so, you know, rewind maybe to, I don't know, 2004 to 2007 or so, I can't tell you how many conversations I had with CEOs of Fortune 500 companies where, you know, we were trying to get them to understand that having a forum on their website was not a bad thing. The immediate feedback was, well, you know, we can't control what people are going to say. They're going to say bad things about our company and our products. And I said, well, look, you know, I mean, my attitude was bottom line, people are out there having those conversations anyway. Either you can let those conversations happen or you can own those conversations and really own the responses to them.
Right.
And once they started looking at it that way, it had some impact. And I think government is much the same way. Politicians, people who are in agencies, people who are providing services need to embrace the negative in a much more dramatic way. And, you know, really, I mean, if it gets pointed out by the public, thank people for pointing it out and then, you know, bring people into the solution, detail how we're going to solve the problem and, you know, what steps are going to be required in order to get something done and, you know, all of that kind of stuff, as opposed to, you know, this closed off organization that is just afraid to have these things come out.
Yep. Yep. We've got another question, looks like, from Jill.
Oh, it's me again. Yeah, quick one. I just want to say that sounds like what you just described sounds like something that would replace resident surveys, which cities can spend thousands of dollars on and not necessarily even know what to do with the data, although the shelf life can be long. What you described is something that can really be done on an ongoing basis, and you know, I couldn't agree with you more that kind of data and information can really help drive not just so much policy decisions, but policy decisions in the way that they're entangled with budget decisions right now. I have been on my city's back for over a year to do some kind of a resident survey, which they've never done in 40 years of existence, in order to help understand what services are valued and to what extent they're valued, to the point of whether or not people would be willing to pay more, and if they were willing to pay more, how much more, and what would they want to sacrifice. If they don't want to pay more, what would drop off? And, you know, it really sounds like what you just described is a kind of tool that would really be useful for that kind of purpose.
Yeah, so two things to add to that. Net Promoter Score, the methodology in general is beautiful because it's very, very simple. You know, the survey that anybody's going to take is going to be, you know, is going to take a few minutes. It's not going to be incredibly detailed, but if it's crafted the right way, it'll still provide a lot of information. And then secondly, the whole purpose of it is for it to be done over and over and over again, obviously with some time between surveying the same people. But the important point about the actual score that comes out of it at the end is not sort of the one-time, you know, line in the sand. It's more the trend, right? And is the trend trending upwards or is it trending downwards, and in what areas and how do we address that?
Right. Great. Well, listen, folks, we're almost done. I'm Brian, I'm going to ask you one last question, which is what's next for you? And are you going to be back in government soon, or where? How do we follow your path going forward? Can you give us a glimpse?
Way to put me on the spot, Mika. you know, it's what I will say is that.
Do you want to stay? Let me ask it a different way. Do you want to stay in government? I mean, having had that experience coming from the private sector, you know, it seems like a very fruitful time to be, you know, trying to deploy these ideas.
So what I'll say is that I loved my job. You know, I woke up every day excited to get to the office and you know, to, you know, start doing things with the folks that I was working with and really just, you know, trying to get stuff done that made a difference in the community.
Mm-hmm.
And I do feel like, to a certain extent, that my time in the public sector was cut a bit short unnaturally.
Mm.
You know, my heart is probably on the entrepreneur side. In a certain sense, just because, you know, I love building things from scratch and, you know, creating new and interesting things out of whole cloth. But at the same time, there's so much opportunity to do good in the public sector and to, you know, bring some of these interesting ideas to the table, that if you do find the right elected official to work for, you know, the world really is your oyster. I mean, you can make a huge amount of difference in a really short period of time. And so, you know, for me right now, I've enjoyed the past few months of unemployment. I've gotten to spend a lot of time with my 22-month-old daughter, which has been great. But and I've got a few options out there. They're all interesting and good, some private sector, some public sector. And that's actually the choice that I'm trying to make right now is, do I stay in the public sector or do I go back to the private sector? So we will see. I will probably tweet a decision when I make it, hopefully.
Okay, you let us know and we'll write it up and we'll keep people posted. And we will follow whatever you do with great interest. Thank you so much, Brian Zivac, former CTO of the City of Washington, D.C. This has been a really, really interesting call on how you can change the culture inside government from someone who's been on the front lines of doing that. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Just a reminder, our next call, which will be in 2 weeks, which we're actually presenting in partnership with the folks at N10, the Nonprofit Technology Network, who are actually, many of them are right now in D.C. at their annual conference. 2 weeks from now, March 31st, it's going to be the Anatomy of a Social Media Success, the It Gets Better project, which was how we'll look deeply on how one single uplifting online video that started in reaction to a really horrific story about the suicide of a gay college student turned into a worldwide movement with thousands of user-created videos and tens of millions of views. We're going to talk to Scott Zumwalt, who is the project manager for the It Gets Better project. That'll be in 2 weeks. Again, thank you to AT&T, our ongoing sponsor for these PDF network calls, for making them happen. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Again, thank you, Brian, and until we are back in 2 weeks, folks, we'll see you online.
My pleasure, Mika. Thanks again.
Take care, Brian.
Bye-bye.